Welcome to the Big Fresh Choice Literacy Podcast. I'm Ruth Ayers, the editor at the Choice Literacy site. We give reliable and timely ideas to uplift student choice and voice by offering weekly content created by in-the-field teachers and school leaders. Everyone deserves for their choice and voice to be honored. This week, we dig into the topic of recognizing bias, which is appropriate as we head into Black History Month. I wrote the lead essay about the way I've confronted some of my biases and the way I miss the mark sometimes. It's not the same. I look different from everyone here, my new son said. I stop in my tracks, right there in the vestibule of the school. Yeah, I said, you do. His previous school was 98% Black. This school was 0.1% Black. He had been calling me Mom for less than a month since we adopted him. I don't like it, he said. In an attempt to connect with him, I knelt beside him and said, everyone has something that is different. I have this crazy curly hair and hated the way people made fun of me for it when I was your age. He looked at me, his deep brown eyes locked with mine. It's not the same, he said. I squeezed his shoulder and he turned and walked toward the second grade hall. I knew he was right, and I knew what I'd said wasn't helpful. I felt ashamed because I knew better. Ever since Andy and I sat through an adoption training about transracial adoption in 2005, we had been living with more open eyes. The question was posed to the room full of white couples, how are you equipped to navigate situations your child will face because of race? Until then, I had never taken the time to consider the answer. We were new on the adoption journey and young in life. As we sat silently and listened to the other responses, we realized we had a lot to learn. We did not know the answer to how we would navigate racism as a transracial family, but we sensed it began with listening and knowing stories from people who had experiences different from ours. So we began drawing a wider circle around our lives, our friendships, reading lives, movie choices, and social media follows all expanded to include more storylines that were different than ours. For more than a decade, we kept opening our eyes wider and wider. Now I was in the school vestibule alone, still kneeling on one knee to be on the same eye level as Jordan. He was walking away from our first conversation about race. I couldn't believe that I blew it. It's not the same, he said. He's no longer a 7-year-old child, but has transformed into a nearly 16-year-old young man. Yet, he still says these same words about many situations. It's not the same. As much as I wish I would have responded differently in the vestibule, the thing I did then that I choose to do again and again is believe him. It's not the same. The truth is, there are many things in this world that I wish would make a beautiful transformation in the blink of an eye, like my son did from child to remarkable young man. No matter how much I wish or attempt to do so, I can't force the transformation of the world. What I can do is the good work of recognizing my own biases again and again and believing the stories of others. The work does not have to be flashy or grandiose, but it does need to be long. In fact, it will last the length of a lifetime. Our articles and videos feature full-time teachers and literacy leaders who spend every day in classrooms. There are 4 to 6 new features published each week for our Classic Classroom members. Our contributors are always learning. The features this week are authentic and help us see the urgency of the work before us. In a course, Christy Rush Levine takes you into her middle school classroom and shares the strategies and techniques she uses with her students to deepen their reflection and understanding of books while conferring. Meaningful Reading Conferences 5-Minute Wonders is free for members and available to purchase for everyone else. On our last podcast episode, Christy spoke of the importance of listening to students and being vulnerable as we enter conversations about race. If you missed it, I hope you'll be able to listen. Christy was our January featured contributor, and as a thank you for her generosity, we gave a donation in her name to the Romeoville Community Pantry. Stella Vialba shares 2020 picture books to celebrate and affirm students' identities. Stella shares more about using picture books to celebrate and affirm identity in her session of the Elementary Contributor course. Find out more on the courses page of our website. In an encore video, Frankie Siberson's students read a blog post from the author of the Lunch Lady series and then talk about books for boys and girls. The ideas from this 2010 video are timeless. In Recognizing Bias, Tara Barnett and Kate Mills reflect on the ways they actively recognize their own biases and help students recognize theirs. It is a raw article. Kate and Tara write, "What we've realized through our discussion on segregation and the inferences about characters in a book that takes place in Africa is that our students come to text with their own biases, just as we do. These are the biases that come from living in a place where most people are like you, and you expect the world to be a fair and just place because it usually is for you. It comes from hearing only one story and not knowing people and their stories in a personal way as friends and peers and neighbors. It comes from not having enough windows into the world that you don't know. We worry what this will mean for our students' understanding of society." Near the end of the article, they write, "So, as we continue to introduce texts to our students with diverse characters and perspectives that offer windows into worlds that they haven't experienced, it's important to recognize that it's not enough to read a text and just feel compassion for the characters in it. There needs to be more." Kate and Tara share how to teach students to recognize their own biases in this must-read article. In What Do You Meme?, Gretchen Schrader teaches her high school students how to notice and combat logical fallacies, a much-needed skill because most of her students use memes as their primary news source. Gretchen and I had a conversation about her article. It was on the Thursday morning following the attack on the Capitol. Gretchen was home quarantined. As stress levels mount, it becomes difficult to continue to honor student choice and voice. Gretchen understands these pressures because she faces them too. Listen in as we talk about how to support students in learning to look at the facts and use their voices rather than respond with emotions. Gretchen Schrader is a longtime contributor. She is involved in the Columbus Area Writing Project and a high school English teacher. Gretchen, you often say that you are exactly half of the English department in your school. Welcome to the Big Fresh podcast. What else do you want to tell us about yourself?
Hi, Ruth. Thank you so much for having me. Yes, I am a high school English teacher. I teach in a small rural community that's just outside of Columbus, Ohio. I'm in my 19th year of teaching, and I teach a variety of classes at my school. I teach AP Literature, AP Language, English 11 for juniors, English 12 for seniors, and I also teach a young adult literature elective as well as a poetry workshop elective.
It's a ton of preps that you have.
It is, but I enjoy the variety, and at this point in my career, I feel like I couldn't do anything else.
This year, you've done a little bit of everything when it comes to instruction, virtual, hybrid, traditional, and right now you're home on quarantine. What an odd school year.
Yes, it definitely is. And it, as a teacher, it has helped me learn to alter my instruction on the drop of a hat and try to make things accessible for students, no matter how they're learning, in person, online. So it's been an adventure and it's been a great learning experience too.
It has been. And I think it's so great to be able to talk with teachers who are in the midst of doing it and to be able to read your thoughts and your articles. It's a lot to be transitioning and figuring out instruction as we go. And then you're still writing about it. So in this week's edition to the Big Fresh, you have an article called "What Do You Meme?" And we also just released your course, Videos and Visuals in Literature Study. So Gretchen, I've been thinking about your work and the way it leads students into deeper thinking. So I thought a good place to begin our conversation is to talk about your approach to content by meeting kids at their points of needs. You often use videos and visuals, even picture books and memes with your high school students as a way to teach sophisticated skills for readers and writers. You teach a million different preps like you just told us, but mostly juniors and seniors, and you're an AP teacher. Why do you value videos and visuals?
Yeah, well, first of all, they're engaging. So I just value their ability to hook students into the content right away. And secondly, they're accessible to all students. So while some students might initially balk at applying a higher level skill to a difficult text, all students feel comfortable trying out those skills with, say, a movie clip or a meme. It's a medium that they're familiar with, and familiarity creates comfort, which makes students more likely to take on an intellectual risk.
So it's a place that you begin, and then you move into more traditional works that we might think of in a high school English classroom?
Exactly. It's sort of a starting point.
And so in your course, Videos and Visuals in Literature Study, you're really cracking open that starting point. So you're showing us how to help students enter analysis in low-risk ways. In your course, I love the way that you guide us to meaningful analysis through tone and mood, characterization, and symbolism. Like, to me, symbolism is just one of those aloof qualities that kids, like, how do they really figure out what it means to take this concrete thing and think about it in an abstract way? And so in your course, you're showing us how to do that with things like artwork and videos. And I was thinking about how sometimes outsiders to our classroom see things like art or memes or picture books as fluff and not really serious enough to be in a high school classroom or an AP class. What do you say in response to an administrator or a colleague questioning the use of videos and visuals to get meaningful analysis of literature?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I can totally understand an administrator's initial concern if they walked by my classroom and saw a movie clip playing, because I think there's a common misconception that if there is a video playing in a classroom, that means that both the teacher and the students have checked out for the day. It's more of just a mental break. But I would definitely invite an administrator or any of my colleagues into my classroom to join into the conversation and just to see how I'm actually using those videos and visuals. So there are two key things to incorporating these into class. So first is using short clips to keep students from zoning out and to make them active viewers. So if I were to show an entire movie and spend the whole class just watching, I know a lot of students would tune out. But giving them something to actively look for, something specific in the clip that we're viewing, keeps them actively thinking. And also, by inviting anyone into my classroom, I would hope that they would see that our classroom discussions, of things like memes that might seem frivolous, really can inspire a deep analysis when you give students the right tools to look at them with.
I think that's so helpful, Gretchen. I remember being, you're like a first or second year teacher. I taught seventh grade language arts and wanting to use a picture book to help me teach kids some craft moves in writing. And I remember feeling nervous about it. And when you just explained that, like how to keep kids active and engaged, I think like when I as a teacher understood the power behind it, then it made me more secure in making some of those choices in my own classroom.
Yeah. And as an early teacher, I was definitely guilty of, you know, showing entire movies just because I really didn't know what else to do. And my own experience in high school was, oh, you read the book and now let's watch the movie. And while there might be some assignment attached with that, I soon realized that, you know, I was using a lot of instructional time up for little gain for my students. And I just wanted to still use those things, but think of a smarter way to do it.
And that's what your course, Videos and Visuals in Literature Study, really show us how to do. So it's not just these like practical tips of things we can do in classrooms, but it's also like the reason behind why they're wise instructional moves. So I'm really excited for people to be able to access that. Your article, What Do You Meme? Kind of does the same thing. So you open the article by sharing a scene from your classroom about a student who admits she gets all of her news from memes. It's interesting to me the way you listened and then responded. So in the article, you write after you share this scene, at first glance, memes can be very persuasive and you might be tempted to agree based on a gut reaction. But memes require a closer analytical look. One of the greatest skills I can arm my students with is the ability to look critically at information they are consuming. This is what you do in your articles. It's like you're looking at what kids are doing, what's happening in pop culture, and then you're asking yourself, how can I get them to think closer and analytically about these things? In the article, you go on to explain that you used to only share the idea of logical fallacies with your seniors, but after this conversation about most of the kids getting news from memes, you decided to share it with all of your students. Will you talk a little bit about why you think it's important and how understanding logical fallacies help us prepare students to be healthy citizens? And maybe even just begin with what is a logical fallacy?
Okay, yes. A logical fallacy is when you look at an argument and you can notice that there is a place where the logic breaks down. And there are lots of common ones like, you know, a hasty generalization where somebody might make an assumption about a whole group of people based on one person's actions, or a slippery slope where we have one thing that happens and then we quickly just bypass all the results and go to the absolute worst thing that could happen as a result. And this student's admission really shocked me because she was our valedictorian, a very intellectual student, very curious about the world. And if I knew that she was getting all of her news, not all of her news, but at least some of her news from memes, then I knew that the majority of my students were doing that as well. And that this was something I really needed to be addressing in my teaching. Because the truth is that my students aren't reading scholarly articles about current events at home. They're looking at memes through social media. So the least I can do is teach them a critical way to look at the information that these memes are presenting. And this is an idea that has been brewing with me for a while, because I'm on social media as well. And just in the past year or so, I was continually seeing memes spread on social media by adults that I knew that were so blatantly falling into these categories of logical fallacies that it was shocking to me as well. And so I started taking screenshots of these as I saw them to save them, because I knew I wanted to be able to use these in a later lesson. And I don't want my students to be negatively impacted by falling for faulty logic.
Yeah. And it was interesting because then you talk about how in your classroom, as the conversation unfolded, you asked kids, what do they do after they see a meme and maybe don't quite understand it? And I think you said half the class does a little bit of light research and the other half, they just ask somebody else to explain it to them.
Yeah. And I think that that's not just a, you know, an issue with students. I think sometimes I've done that myself. You just kind of think, you know, oh, okay, I'll bypass that. I won't really put a lot of thought into it. But I think that's where the danger lies in memes, when we don't think about them. And if my students don't know how to think about them, then that's what they'll do.
Yeah. You were talking about a couple of the common logical fallacies and mentioned hasty generalization and slippery slope. In your article, you share 5 different logical fallacies that are pretty common. And I live with 3 teenagers. And as I was looking through these logical fallacies, I was like, you know, this is kind of their argument all the time.
Yes.
But I was wondering if we could just go through those common logical fallacies just to help, you know, listeners think through a little bit more about some of the common ones that we see in memes. So you had mentioned a hasty generalization and a slippery slope. Another one in your article you talk about is the either-or fallacy.
Mm-hmm. An either-or fallacy creates a false dilemma. So the speaker poses a problem as having only 2 solutions, and one of those is very obviously a terrible choice, which leads the viewer or the reader to immediately side with the more positive choice. But what the either-or fallacy does is it simplifies an argument, and it leaves out all of the nuance and gray area that is often involved in a major choice.
Yeah. And, you know, teenagers say this to their parents all the time, right? Like, if you don't let me go out to eat, my life is over. And it's this either or fallacy.
Exactly.
Ad hominem. Tell us about that.
So this is a term that literally means against the man. And this is the one that students can most obviously pick out, because it just refers to name calling and personal attacks that are used as an argument when in fact they're, you know, just an attack. And so during, you know, political election season, students are able to find these logical fallacies very readily in social media and the news and political ads.
They are easy to pick out. And I think, like, when I was looking at the terminology that you share, this is a very scholarly word. And so it's just another way that you're lifting that level of the work you're doing in your classroom. So instead of, say, you know, personal attacks or calling each other names, you're giving it the scholarly name of ad hominem for your students.
Yeah, I think it's important with ad hominem to share with students that a personal attack is not an argument. It's just an attack. But many times they are presented as if it were an argument. And I want them to be able to distinguish the difference.
It is true. You know, attacks are not arguments. And in today's world, it's important work for young adults to understand that. So the final logical fallacy that you share in the article is the appeal to authority.
Yes. Yeah, so this is another easily found fallacy in advertising that students can usually come up with examples. But in this fallacy, the opinion of someone that's just well-known or famous is used as evidence to support an argument. And the problem here lies with, is that person truly an expert on the issue? And are they just being used because of their fame and notoriety?
Yeah, we do see that all over social media, trying to appeal to authority. And then when you really think about it, the person who's speaking maybe doesn't have authority in that area, but they're well recognized. So I was thinking about how memes are intended to be funny, but sometimes the humor can be offensive. Now, I've had the pleasure of getting to be in your classroom and watching you interact just on an ordinary day with your kids. And I know that humor is part of who you are and part of how you live in a classroom. You've written articles about humor, and your articles, even this one, is typically peppered with some humor. So I was thinking about this article, and in the article, you're sharing examples and they're all political. How did you navigate using memes that are politically charged when there were likely opposing political beliefs among your students? How did the conversation stay focused on the literary work rather than an argument based on politics?
Yes, that was something that definitely came into my mind. And in the past, I have been afraid to address politically charged issues in my classroom for a variety of reasons. But one of the major ones was being that the discussion would maybe get out of control and I wouldn't be able to rein it back in. But never bringing these issues up or teaching my students how to deal with them is actually doing them a great disservice. And so with the meme lesson, I tried to remind myself that I was teaching students how to break down the logic in the meme. I wasn't asking whether they agreed or disagreed with the message. And so the focus was on the logic and the skill rather than their emotional opinions that they might have. So my hope is that when students see the logic breakdown, that they'll see how weak these arguments are, and then that might influence their opinions in the future.
So no knockdown, drag out arguments in your classroom over these
memes. No. And again, that was, you know, in the back of my mind, that was always a fear that I have when I bring up a controversial topic. But like I said, focusing the lesson, not so much on, you know, what is your opinion on this, but let's look at this and break it down. We're focusing on logical fallacies and then letting students come to their own opinions based on what we've done in class.
It's such important work. And I was thinking about how logical fallacies are a good first step in helping people see their own biases. Why is it important for teachers to reflect and consider ways to recognize bias? And I know that you're engaging in this journey. And so I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, as I just mentioned, in the past, I let that fear of controversial topics like politics and race just prevent me from addressing them at all, or just kind of glossing over them in a way that, you know, wasn't really meaningful. But I realized that my own silence on these issues was also making a pretty bold statement. And that was not the statement that I wanted to make with my students. So the change for me in thinking was to focus on facts and content and using those to ground my teaching of topics. So just for example, just this morning, you know, I woke up early thinking about what happened yesterday in Washington at the U.S. Capitol. And I thought, how can I address this with my students? I mean, it's something that's on my mind and I know it's on their mind as well. And one of the skills that we focus on in AP language is analyzing diction or a person's word use. And so I was thinking about in the headlines and on the news I was reading, all of the different terms that were used to describe the people who broke into the U.S. Capitol. I was seeing protesters, patriots, rioters, pro-Trump mob, and those are just a few of the things that I saw. And so asking my students today to consider the word choice and think about what are the connotations of each of these terms, and using that to begin a conversation. Then we can discuss how different words can change the narrative, how they can affect the tone of a headline or a news article. And so we're practicing a skill that just so happens to be relevant to today's news. And it brings up the conversation, but it focuses emotions by keeping it skill-based. And then I consider that maybe the next time students read a headline, that they'll think about the diction and the word choice and the intentions of the writer by examining that a little more closely.
It's such a beautiful mindset, the idea of let's talk about what's relevant to kids. Let's go to where they are. We know they're on social media. We know they're in memes. And we know that they're seeing what's happening in the world around us. And your stance is to honor that and not tell kids what to think, but give them the tools to do some deeper thinking and analysis about it.
Yeah. And I think my hope is that by having lessons like that, that I'm also modeling how you can have a productive discussion about something that maybe is very politically charged without it, you know, moving into the emotional realm. And maybe my students will see that as a way to discuss that with, you know, their parents or other family members, or even just other people that have differing opinions as them, just to kind of focus on what is being said and the logic of an argument, rather than just very quickly escalating, you know, into emotions.
Gretchen, it's such important work. And I really appreciate that you are letting us know your thinking behind it, that you're taking us into your classroom, and it's, you know, it's in the heart of the country, in a small rural town, and you are continuing to open minds to give deep roots to the kind of thinking that kids can do and the analysis. So we started the conversation about using videos and visuals, and our conversation weaves around to the current events in the country. And I think that's the power, right, of visuals and videos, is that it gives kids a low risk way to enter into some really weighty topics. What are some final words of encouragement for teachers to consider doing this kind of work?
I would just say that we all know our students live in a world full of video and visuals. And so arming them with some tools to analyze them more deeply is going to hopefully make them more thoughtful consumers of information. And for myself as a teacher, when I'm searching for videos and visuals to use in class, it keeps me on my toes, and it ensures that my lessons are fresh and relevant, and that they're meeting the needs of my students.
Gretchen, thanks so much for joining us, for helping us. I know it's helped me just open my mind and really think about, like, there's the skills that we teach every year, but then the way that we go about that can shift according to our students' needs. And I appreciate your comments about how it's courageous teaching and to remain silent on some of the things that kids are wrestling most with. That's not always the most fair thing to do either. So thank you for giving us some ways to think about how to help kids have conversations and how to help kids do a little bit deeper reflection or analysis about the things they see in the world.
Thank you so much for having me, Ruth. And I just want to end with the fact that, you know, I'm not perfect with doing this either, and it is hard and it does take bravery, but you can only start and only get better as you go.
Our contributors are listening and looking hard for those spontaneous, teachable moments when they can move a child forward as a reader and writer. Each week, we offer free articles to empower all educators to do the same. Katrina Edwards is horrified when a student response reveals cultural gaps in her first grade classroom library. In her article, Culturally Responsive Texts, she researches possibilities for expanding the diversity of texts and shares an annotated bibliography linking different cultures and curricular possibilities. This feature was first published in 2016, yet the ideas and inspiration are still relevant today. When it comes to including and understanding others, it may be hardest to empathize with those who disrupt or bully others. Tammy Mulligan shares her 4 favorite mentor texts for opening discussions to consider the humanity within all of us. The article, Whose Point of View Matters? Considering Multiple Perspectives, was first published in 2019. Our Leaders Lounge is dedicated to literacy coaches and school leaders, and you will find 2 to 4 new features each week. Are you working with teachers virtually? Make sure to check out our course, Virtual Coaching, Working with Individuals. Experienced literacy coaches share their strategies for adapting their one-on-one coaching techniques to a remote environment, free for Literacy Leader members. In Harnessing the Power of Change, David Pittman reflects on the change cycle and determines ways to make the best of it. He deepens our understanding of the change cycle by sharing about the annual camping trip he takes with his 2 young sons. In this week's Coaching Minute, literacy coach Jean Russell explains why she captures videos of her coaching debriefs with teachers and how these videos serve as powerful tools for learning. Listen to 1619, a podcast from The New York Times, an audio series on how slavery has transformed America, connecting past and present through the oldest form of storytelling. Tara Barnett and Kate Mills reference episode 5 in their article, Recognizing Bias. We know the pressure that can come from curriculum mandates, so Choice Literacy is a proudly independent community. We are not associated with any commercial publisher. We don't recommend packaged or scripted programs. You can trust our content because it is created by people just like you, educators who show up to school each day and are enamored by students. You can find links to all of the articles discussed in the show notes, or sign up for the Big Fresh newsletter so you can have the links delivered directly to your inbox. Keep offering choice and voice to students in what they read and write, because everyone deserves for their choice and voice to be honored. Shine on, everyone.